Okay, so my name is Melissa. I'm an alcoholic still, and I'm your 10-minute speaker. Thank you, Bill, in the back there for asking me. Oh my gosh. And so it was suggested to me when I first came here to not, to always say yes to anything asked of me. And I've tried to maintain that, and even though I really am very uncomfortable up here, all by myself, I'm going to go ahead and speak for 10 minutes and hopefully share my experience, strength, and hope. I first got sober in 2013, went back out, and then this last time, it's November, my sobriety date is November 8th of 2016. And so it's been a long road. It seems like I was born to be an alcoholic. I grew up in an alcoholic home, a lot of addiction to other substances, including food. And I just wanted to belong. So when my dad used to ask me to be out working on cars, let's go in there and give you a beer. And I'd say, Dad, can I have a sip? I was probably four or five. I was old enough to push a chair up to the refrigerator and climb up. He kept it on the top shelf in our green Frigidaire, avocado green Frigidaire. And so that was in the 70s. And I'd pop that beer and I'd taste that sip, and it tasted like horrible. But I loved that I belonged, and I loved that my father had asked me to do something for him. I was the youngest of five kids. There were five of us born in 10 years. By the time I came along, Mom and Dad were done being parents, but unfortunately, they weren't done, because I put them through the ringer like my siblings did before me, and in order to fit in, that's what I did. I drank, and I drank a lot, and I used other substances, and then I tried to control it, you know. I went through that crazy stage it describes in the book. My last stint out, I was with a man who said, I just want a woman who can drink normally. Boy, I'm that woman. I'm going to control it because you're that important. So I went from, you know, tequila to whiskey and whiskey to beer and, you know, maybe just one beer. Well, my max was three, so I'd have 10. I couldn't control it, and I knew that for a long time. And I just kept trying. The insanity, you know, just kept trying because I wanted to fit in. Those people that I hung around with, they weren't sober. they were drinkers. And so that's what I did until November 7th. And life had become so unmanageable. My then 16-year-old daughter had told me that if I ever drank again, she was never coming home. So initially I got sober for her because I needed the money, you know, that I got from welfare, you know. So I thought, well, I'll get sober and do their program and then drink again. But then once I got sober, it was horrible because then I actually had to deal with my shit. Pardon me. I had to deal with my shit, the wreckage I had created, the years and years and years of absolute chaos. I have two older sons, and bless their hearts, they're, you know, independent grown, and my daughter was just a force. So I got sober and then started dealing with my wreckage, and it was a lot of pain, and I just had to hang on. People in the group told me, just hang on, keep coming back, it does get better. And I was a bawling mess, you know, I was a wreck. I didn't have any place to live at one point. I lost my place where my daughter and I were living, and I was homeless for a week, and I had a friend who said, hey, come stay with us, he's a drug addict. But I thought, you know, he's been my friend for years. I don't smoke pot, so, you know, I'll be okay there. So I've been there for a year and a half, and I'm just ready to get the hell out. But I just tried to put my life back together. And the only way it's been possible is by actually working a program and being responsible and saying yes when I just absolutely mean no. And showing up early and try to stay late. I smoke a lot, so it's easy for me to drink a lot of AA coffee and, you know, go outside and smoke. And I pray every morning and I pray every night. And I had a relationship with God. My relationship with God growing up was going to a lot of different churches, you know. My mom wanted us out of her hair, and so all of us kids were shipped off on the bus to the various churches in Porterville. And I actually did believe in God. I just thought God abandoned me, you know. Obviously, I'm not worth anything, and so God just left me hanging. And so I was really angry for a long time, and then coming into the program, like I said, it really gave me a basis for being a believer, and a believer in this program, until I could actually believe and, you know, recreate my relationship with my higher power. Because I had gone from this place to that place. I had gone from this drug to that drink to that person to this bar to everywhere, trying to find that hole that was inside of my heart. And the only thing that has worked for me, the absolute only thing that's worked for me, has been Alcoholics Anonymous. This is it. The last road on the block, the last house on the block, is what I was told. Yeah, this is it. This is the end of the line for me. I was that alcoholic in the end that I just wanted to die. And I was dying lousy inside. I looked good on the outside. I made sure of that. That's all I had left, was to look good. And I felt like the worst of the worst inside. And so I hung on tight. And I kept coming back. And I do what's asked of me. And I have so many sponsors that's sick. I'm so sick. I need multiple, and I need a big group of friends that will love me until I can actually love myself. Because I hated myself, and I have moments where I still do. And I think I will never get out from under the financial crap I've created. And I will never get out from under the horrible relationships that I did damage to, that I caused. Or that my, you know, my drinking and who I was then in the drink caused for me. But it does happen bit by bit and piece by piece. And other people telling me that I'm doing really good, I don't believe it. But I have to at some point keep hearing it to believe it. And I have to keep praying for that. That I will feel good about me. That I wasn't created to be miserable. I wasn't created to be alone. I wasn't created to be a mar on society. That I'm actually a good person. That I actually can contribute something good. And it took being sober, and it takes being sober. I have one sip, I'm your worst enemy. Or I'm going to love on you till you're sick. I mean, that's kind of drunk I am. And being here sober, I can love on everybody all the time and be who I am and still be loved by you. And with that, I'll keep coming back. My name is Melissa. I'm an alcoholic. Thank
you. Hi, everybody. My name's Ed. I'm an alcoholic. This little guy reminded me of one of our meetings down years ago. It happened now, but one of our meetings down in the San Fernando Valley, when I got, that's where I got sober, west end of the San Fernando Valley. And it was a Friday night big Mason Lassen group, 150 people, and they were reading chapter 5 as we did here, and they got to step 7, humbly asking to review our shortcomings, and one of the little guys yelled, "No!" And everybody understood that. Well, I was born in a little town called Washington, Pennsylvania. It's about 35 miles outside of Pittsburgh. And when I was first started drinking, I'd hang around those bars. It was like a little small country town. My dad and mother had 10 acres. And I would tell people in the bar, "Well, you can take the boy out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the boy." Then years later, when I ended up being struck sober in my case and was going through these steps, I did that inventory, and I found out the only thing I remember from that country was bad stuff, and I was afraid. So everything changed after I took that inventory. I was a sissy when I was a little boy. My brother was, I'm from six children, I'm one of six. Girl, boy, girl, my brother a year older than me, myself, and my sister a year younger. So my brother a year older would go down, there was a stream that came through our property, and that green moss that grows on the stream, he'd pick it up with a stick and say, "This is the devil," and throw it at me, and I'd scream and run up to the house. And then one time I remember them leaving me out in the snow. I had galoshes but no shoes on, and all the other brothers and sisters were laughing at me through the window in the house, and I was out in the snow crying, but I wouldn't walk up to the porch and go in. Does that make me what I am today? I don't know. But I am what I am today, that's for sure. Then the incident happened. When I was 6 years old, my mother caught my dad sleeping with her sister in their bed. Women do not like that. So he was 86. That's when we moved to Pittsburgh, and I guess my dad and mother worked it out together. I don't know. We ended up in a nice medium, whatever you call that, neighborhood, all the working people, but good people. And there were three or four very poor people, very poor families in that whole community, and we were one of them. And everything that happened, they said, oh, those Perry boys. And it was us. So they tell me that when I was three or four, prior to our leaving the country, what we called the country, my mother and dad would have other farmers over, and they'd have these little shindigs. I was told that after these shindigs, I would go around 3 or 4 years old, and I would finish up the little drinks that was left in the glasses. I don't remember that, but they tell me I did that. Does that make me what I am today? I don't know, but I am what I am today. And so after the incident, we moved to Pittsburgh, and everything went okay. You know, we were very poor, but I didn't know it. I mean, I just played with the other kids, the other boys. We had our little gang, we called it. And if we got mad at you or you got mad at me, we were out of the gang for about 45 minutes, and then everybody made up, and we were back at it again. One time, Mikey Koza, one of my wonderful friends from back then, he lived in the upstairs of a duplex, and he threw a rock, and I was on the reverse slope of this yard, and he got me. A really good throw. He got me right here. We were little kids, and I ran home crying, and all that stuff, and got bandaged up, and his mom and my mom were on the phone arguing, and we were back out playing again. We were children. Children forget things. Anyway, as I got a little older, when I got into the eighth grade in Pittsburgh, they give you citywide tests. I don't know if they do that everywhere, but these citywide tests, you get the results in ninth grade. And in ninth grade, they called my mother up, somebody from the high school, said, keep after this boy. He's doing second year college English. He's equal to this. He's doing that. He's doing the other. And a guy across the street, the boy hit me with a stone. His dad was, he knew some people. Let's put it that way. And I didn't know that at the time. I learned that later. And he told me, you go out and you excel in three sports in high school. I don't care what they are. I'm going to get you into West Point. And by that time, my oldest brother had gone into the Marines. And I told him, oh, no, I'm going to go in the Marines. He just got feverish. He said, you know what I'm offering you? He yelled. I didn't know. And by that time, I was sold in the Marine Corps because of my brother. Anyway, my point about that being tested is, in 11th grade in Pittsburgh back then, they gave you these same tests to see how you've progressed. And in the 12th grade, you get the results, and the principal called me in his office. And he was a hard kind of guy, and I was thinking to myself, because, you know, I'm a senior. This guy messes with me, I'm going to drop him. Blah, blah. So I got into the principal's office, and he said, Ed, it's not your fault, it's our fault. I get this way sometimes. He turned his tests around, and all the way down, it was hardly a difference. All the same from those years of high school. What happened then? My oldest brother came back from Korea, and I started drinking. That was the change. Everything was redirected. My heroes were no longer Superman and Flash Gordon, if anybody remembers them. My heroes now were the bad boys, because my oldest brother was one of those guys, if you want him down, you better take a big two-fisted club, and you better pray he does not get up. He was one of those, he really was. Tough guy. So anyway, that was my start in drinking, and I would get dressed on Friday, I no longer hung around with the school kids. I went down to this old Texaco gas station where these veterans of the Korean War, including my brother and a couple other ones, would get together, and I'd be make myself presentable because, you know, they might take me with them. And every now and again on a Friday, they'd say, come on, kid, you might as well go with us. And, you know, it's not the same today as it was back then. If you could reach the bar back then, you could have a beer. And I remember one particular night they took me down there and said, go get us some beer, and they gave me some money. And the beer back then was Iron City beer, Pittsburgh, you know. And so I went up to the bar and I said, give me three Iron Cities. And the guy said, what? And I yelled, give me three Iron Cities. He said, that's better, and he gives me three beers. You know, they were turning, they were learning me. So anyway, when I became, everything changed, and I stopped, went to high school. I started working at a drive-in, the old drive-in restaurants. Was in Pittsburgh, it was called Eaton Park. It was one of the first ones. And they had the car hop service. Didn't have the roller skates back then. It's hard to roller skate in the snow. But I started working there. We had a wonderful time. We'd close that joint up at 12:30 or 1:30 in the morning, go up to a joint called the Gonzales Club and drink till the light was coming through the fan in the wall. And it's just, we were talking, oh, stop, Ed. I want to thank Brent for allowing me to, see, I forget to do that. Me, you know. I want to thank Brent and for allowing me to be here. I want to thank all of you for allowing me to be here. This is really a great pleasure. I was a barroom drinker. At the end of my drinker, they weren't pleased to see me. Not that I was Mr. Bad Boy, but I don't know what I did wrong. But I'd walk in and I'd sit down at the end of the bar. And when I first started drinking, especially once I came to California, which I deserted my family the first time and came to California, and I ended up making some pretty good money through a bunch of stuff. And when I walk in the bar back then, Mr. Perry, and they'd twirl the doily at me, and they'd pour me what my drink was. And at the end of my drink, and I'd be sitting down at the end of the bar, same place, they'd be looking down, three of them talking, they'd be looking down, including the bartender, and finally, Ed, you know, I was that unwelcome hanger-oner like Bill Wilson talked about. I loved the barroom. For a long, long time, I loved the whole process of getting drunk. I loved, like, if I'd get a late start, 9:30 or 10 a.m., and I'd walk into Big John's. Big John's had swinging doors. I loved swinging doors. And I'd be wearing my bomber jacket because I'm about to get bombed. And I'd walk up to the bar and put that foot on the brass rail just above a whisper, kind of like Clint, you know, beer. And the sweet little gal came down and pour me a beer. And we'd sit there and everything was quiet, and the only light in the place was over the pool table, and it was all smoky. And I just loved it. And later on, some guy asked me about something that I knew nothing about, so I answered him. And we start talking back and forth. And that goes on for a while. Then about 5:30 in the evening, the gals started coming in from work. And next thing you know, I'm up and dancing with them. One of us might fall in a booth now and again. It can happen. We just get back up and start dancing again. And that's the way we, you know, that. And that was just it. And it always ended up the same way. Come on, Ed. We want to go home. And Mr. Dignified Ed would pick up his slobber coming down, you know, off it, trying to wipe it off the bar so I don't, you know, make a scene. And that was pretty much the way I drank for a long, long time, and I just loved it. I loved getting drunk. I had trouble with employment. I was a good worker, as a lot of alcoholics that I've observed are. But I had a little trouble. Peggy says she came up with it, but I think I came up with this. I quit a career, not just a job, but I quit a career because he accused me of something that I did. I really have trouble with that. And so then I went over. I was a bakery driver for an up-and-coming bakery back in those days. And they had some really good routes and stops. And they called me the banker because I had the best route in the joint shortly after I got there. And when they accused me of something I did, I said, I'm about ready to let you people carry the ball yourselves. And the boss man said, oh, anytime. And I walked over and circled 2 weeks later on the calendar and said, that'll be my last day. And he had the nerve to say, okay. So I quit that job, and then then I learned after that why they called me the banker. I learned what it really meant to be a bread man. I went to a different bakery where you have 112 different items, 43 stops. This one will take two white, and that'll take a rye bread. And before I rolled those hamburger buns off on a lift gate truck and took them to this fast food place. So I learned what it really was to be a bread man. And I would go through periods where I did not drink. I was one of those. I was taught my whole life, drinking's bad. And yet my mother would talk about her dad. He'd come home stewed. He worked in the steel mills in Pittsburgh way, way back. He was also a prize fighter when they went knuckle to knuckle. And they went until somebody fell. He was my height, but he was a big man this way. And so I lost my place. Okay. So anyway, I'll take up where I remember. I quit that job. I went to different bakeries. My family, see, after I quit that job, it took several weeks. But then I had a wife and two children back then. Not the same one. Not this one. But that first wife of mine, she started saying things like, we're hungry, you know. We'd like to eat. And so I went and got another job at another bakery, as I said. Went through a season with this bakery, a season with another bakery, and they wanted to keep me on, but I got my second DUI. When I got my first DUI, I knew it was just a mistake. Because the guy turned me around and said, you had the right to remain silent. I said, this is me. This is just an error, misunderstanding here. And so I got a DUI. A year and a half later, I got another DUI. And that time I realized what they were going to do, and I just thought, eh. And the first time they gave me, this is back then, of course, $125 and I think $26 court costs or something. So I paid it and left. And I got that second one, and I went in front of the judge because I figured a person will do the same with the second one. And I forget if I said guilty or whatever happened. I'm not guilty or whatever happened. And I remember him looking at me and saying, do you want to go to jail? And he kind of sobered me up a bit. And so I ended up getting an attorney. And I found out later, if I'd have known all the attorney was going to do, I just went to jail for 10 days and whatever work took. Because this guy cost me $1,000. And I guess things were changing by that time. Cost me $1,000 and all I did was stay out of jail. Still lost my driver's license, and that bakery couldn't keep me on, of course. So then, after I got my license back and got rolling along again, in 1977, my brother asked me, he was a bakery driver. When I went to the bakery for a job, when I got to California in 61, this was in Santa Monica, went to the bakery for a job, my younger sister said, these aren't the kind of guys, she worked there, these aren't the kind of guys I can recommend you to, but I'll tell you, there's a guy getting fired for drinking. So I went down on Friday and put my application in, and the owner's son was a young fella. He looked at me and said, are you Susie's brother? And I said, yes, I am. He said, oh, we're not in the habit of hiring relatives. And I said, oh, and I thanked him for his time. And his dad was sitting over there like this in the corner, sitting there watching me. Found out later his dad was a master baker, wonderful baker. So anyway, I figured so much for that. So then I went home and I got a call Sunday to come to work. So I did get hired there. And before we were all done working, there was four of the family working in that place that wasn't accustomed to hiring family. So then I, in 1977, my brother kept saying things to me, like, come out of the roofing business, man. You'll throw stones at that bread business. So I didn't know. He didn't know a thing about roofing. He went in 2 years early and doubled the business that the guy had before him. So I said, okay, I'll go and start working for you. And he said, tell your family, you're not going to see them for 6 months. You're going to live with me night and day. We're going to run. I'm going to teach you this. I'm going to do that. That was in August of 77, and we had rain for like 30 days straight. And we got stacks of things to look at, just stacks and stacks of roofs to look at. He just showed me how to measure them and said, go get them. And so that's the way I started in the roofing business. Anyway, in 1980 or 81, I had a really, really bad New Year's Eve. And so I gave up drinking again. And so I came back after New Year's when I was better. and told all the guys, we had two crews working, and I said, I'm not drinking for a year. And they lined up to take a piece of the action. I'll take a piece. I'll take $50. I'll take a 5 weeks later, I paid off $610 that I had bet other people that's last a year. And that was the best damn beer I've tasted in years. I was happy to pay off just to do that. So that's the way I was. I had this philosophy for a long time when I understood what and who I was. Because I did go to AA in 63, you know. I was 25 years old. My first wife sent me. Said, you don't drink like a normal person. And I said, so what do I do? She said, you need to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, really? You know, brand new red Chevy outside, making above every... You talking to me? And so I said, okay, call and make an appointment for me. And she did. There's a place called The Center, 26th and Broadway in Santa Monica. I went up there and there's this guy, old geezer, younger than I am now. Cauliflower ears, pug nose, talk like this. And I said, you know, my wife has sent me here. I don't think I'm an alcoholic. I think I'm just a drunk. We don't know that we don't know. And he said, tell me, what's the difference? And he had. So he read to me out of here, especially, you know, the doctor's opinion, and told me about that taking the first drink and then you're stuck. And I said, that's it. I guess I am one of those. Anyway, I started going to meetings and they paid a lot of attention to me, and I lasted 3 or 4 months. Went by a bar, saw a guy called Uncle Lou. His truck was in there, so I thought I'd stop and say hi. And got stewed to the eyeballs. And then when I got better, I called my sponsor then. And he said, we do that once in a while when we first get here, it happens. You've got to redouble your efforts. No idea what the man was talking about. No idea. So I started back on the meeting. You know, they paid a lot of attention to me. I was 25 years old in 1963. There weren't a whole bunch. There were some young folks, but not a whole bunch. So they you know, give me, look at this, because whole life ahead of them, give me that business. And so anyway, 3 weeks went by. What had happened that I understand today that I didn't understand then, for lack of a better word, the devil was back. I had drunk again. And when I drink again, I don't forget that. I've got an obsession of the mind. My disease centers in my mind. 3 weeks later, I got drunk again. I said, well, I called him up, told him, so I'll call him up again and tell him. So I said, Blackie, I'm sorry, I got drunk again. I've got a sensitive nature. And Blackie said something I didn't care for. Blackie said, well, now you're being a chump. And I said, oh, what's this? And hung up the phone. My first wife tells me that every 5 to 7 years after that, I would go back to AA for anywhere from 1 day to 3 weeks, and then I'd leave again. I remember a couple of visits, not all of them. So anyway, that was that. So in 77, I go in with my brother in the roofing business, have that bad day, that bad New Year's. And then a friend of mine, a drinking buddy of mine, haven't heard from him since it stopped, you know. But we drank a lot. You know, in the business I was in, now and again, you could carry a lot of money with you. And this guy, we called him KW, and he and I used to say, Eddie, you got some money, I'm a little low, and I'd give him $400. Or if I was low, I'd say, Kenny, you got any money? And he'd give me $300-$400. We just did that back and forth. I think he got the better of me. I think I got sober and never saw him again. I think he owed me $400. Well worth it. Anyway, he said, Eddie, don't get them damn drunk driving things. I live 5 doors up. My door's always open. Come in and flop. What is better than that? When I did, you know, get home, sometimes I didn't get home for a while, but when I did get home, I told that first wife, I'm never going to get another DUI. KW said, come up and stay at his place, and then when you come to the next day, just shake yourself loose and go home. And you know what that ungrateful woman said? What's the matter with not drinking? Whoa! What kind of shenanigans is that? I thought in here, I'm doing everything I can to hold this family together and bring peace here. And you come up with that. And that didn't fly. So anyway, due to a series of unfortunate incidents and 50 or 60 bad breaks, and quitting jobs, and a friend of mine putting me together on a, as a mule on a construction gang, and they messed with me. The first thing they had me do was pick up like a 4x12 or something, 6x12. And, you know, this is as heavy as I've ever been. I was a long, skinny guy then, and they were doing it on purpose. Pick that up and take it over there and put it over there by the snack. And I tried to pick that sucker up, and I could hardly get it up off the ground. I felt like Jesus dragging the cross. And I finally got that baby up and got it on my shoulder. It was digging into my shoulder. I'm an alpha, you know. I wasn't going to let them know. I walked that sucker over there and dropped it. Because I wasn't going to let them know. My shoulder hurt for weeks after that. Anyway, there's different jobs like that. And then my daughter. I might get emotional, okay? I'm an unemotional kind of person sometimes. Sometimes I consider myself emotionally unstable. Anyway, my daughter, July 1964, called that first wife and I up, and she told us she's addicted to cocaine. Could we get her in some kind of program? Knocked me on my butt. Knocked me sideways. I knew she was a drunk. I drank at the same joint for 25 years. Found this out a little later when we were both sober. She and her girlfriend would run out of money. They'd come over where I drank because I'd just say, give them whatever they want. She was pretty cool. So I knew she was a good drunk, but the other part I didn't know anything about. She went into a 28-day program, and they had them A&A meetings in there. Every Wednesday and Friday, we'd go downstairs to an A&A meeting. And then they'd go through the routine. Any new friends among us? My first wife would look at me like this. My daughter would be looking at me like this. So about the third or fourth time, I thought, oh, crap. I raised my hand as a newcomer, you know. And I said way in here where I live, this doesn't work for an alcoholic of my type. I've already been here. I know about this. I didn't know about this. I didn't know nothing. In fact, I was talking to a wonderful gentleman named Ralph after I was coming around here. The first 7.5 months I came back, incidentally, my daughter stayed sober from that day, is sober today. That gets me. She's sober, excuse me. She's sober 7.5 months longer than me. She was 20 years old, 30 days before her 21st, I'm sorry, I don't know, right around her 21st birthday. We caught her spitting up blood one day, an afternoon, rushed her over to a hospital. Doctor told her she had the stomach of a 50-year-old woman. He said, you're shot, lady. And she went on one more tooth, 30 days later ended up in that program. And been a sober ever since. She sets the world on fire. She does. She's known all through the Palmdale, Lancaster area for helping people with mortgages and crap like that. Anyway, that 7.5 months from the time we ended up going to that first A&A meeting to the time I ended up being struck sober, I got drunk 6 different times. And I came to really like the people, like you guys and gals. We're just having a blast with you guys and gals. And I got drunk 6 different times, and I really wanted what you guys had, and I decided that I either have something in here that you guys don't have, or I don't have something in here that you guys have, but I just can't get it. Which subconsciously meant I can drink. That's what it really meant. And I told this guy named Ralph, wonderful guy, Ralph, I think I am an alcoholic of a type. And he said, well, you are. You're the type that still wants to drink. They just always have an answer for you. So anyway, I decided after getting that drunk that 6th time, it got so in meetings, they'd say, anybody here with less than 30 days? And they'd look over to see if I did or didn't. And I can tell you, that was the worst days of my life, drinking or otherwise, because I really wanted what you have. I'd hear these guys talking about, I'm back when I was 5 years sober, we were at the old Grand Station building, and then we moved up. And I thought, man, if I could just be that. If I could just be that. And I couldn't get there. So I wasn't going to go to meetings anymore. And my daughter, who was going to a lot of meetings, she told on me, the guys that I knew, my dad's not going to meetings anymore. So this guy, about 5 feet tall and 5 feet wide, came up to my house. Here, you're not going to meetings anymore. I said, no, there's no sense. You know, what I really felt was, why am I going to dirty up this place? You people are being good. And I don't know how to be good, so why bother? So he started talking. They don't know you drank it, but they did. They don't know you drank. You paid thousands and thousands of dollars for that seat. That's your seat. Don't tell them. They want you to raise your hand. Don't raise your hand. They had none of their business. And I wasn't feeling very well. And so I got a little tired. And I said, all right, I'll go to the meeting with you. And that was Saturday night, commercial away. The first half is participation. The last half is the main speaker. And we got in there and sat down. And everybody knew that I drank again. Because, you know, they all hung around. You know how it is. It's a neighborhood. It's a community. And when you drink, one of us would drink back there, we'd go across the valley. Boom, 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 boom. Ed drank. Boom, 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 boom. And everybody found out. So I went back to went down to that meeting, sitting in my usual position. And they asked if any newcomers here, and that friend that brought me raised my hand. Don't double cross you here. You got to watch it. And I could just feel that heat and that shame and all that crap going up back of my neck. And the lady that led that meeting that particular night, February 19th, 1985, I don't know her to this day. She didn't know me, doesn't know me. But she was leading, there's 120 people, a good sized meeting like this. And she's leading the meeting. And the first has her participation, she said, I want to hear from this guy over here. And I'm like everybody did. And he's talking to you, butthead. Oh, and I cleaned that up. And so I thought, oh, crap. And I got up there and sniveling, and I don't want to give up. And then, you know, sniveling in my self-pity. Got all done, and then different ones got up there, and blah, blah, blah. And they have a break like we do here. And during the break, this one guy came up and said, man, you said you don't want to give up. The whole thing is you give up. This is your doctor. If you have tuberculosis, you go to the doctor. He makes you better. You come to AA, we make you better. And just kind of like, just, you know, it wasn't fair. Too shallow, too selfish, couldn't dump it. So anyway, then the late main speaker got up and she said, her name was Aileen, lived out in the high desert. Wonderful gal, got to know her later. And she said, before I get my talk, I want to say something to Ed. I thought, oh, crap. She said, you said you're missing the boat. Honey, you're in the boat. Grab an oar and row like hell. And everybody laughed, and I wanted to jump up. What are you talking about, grab the oar? You're saying take the step. What are you, take them off the wall? I had no idea. I couldn't, wasn't in here. So anyway, the whole meeting, I just felt like I was blowing up inside. And at the end of the meeting, you know, ran a big, big, fat circle, said the prayer like sissies. And I ran out and jumped in my truck, and I was driving up Owens Mouth. And like a sparkly rain shower right over me. I've known her since. I was transformed. I didn't do that. I've never quit drinking. I haven't quit drinking today. I don't drink. I've been neutralized. I did not do that. I found nobody in AA who said, yeah, I'm the one who did that. Although my friend Dan did try to tell me it was him. He tried to tell me it was him. But I ran into the house telling my wife, I'm the alcoholic, I'm the disease, I've known ever since. The next morning I called up a fellow and told him what happened. I didn't know what happened. He said, my friend, you've had a sudden spiritual experience. You're an alcoholic, you'll forget that if you don't take these steps. And I heard him. And so I got hold of a guy who used to sit in meetings with a toothpick in his mouth, looking across the table at me saying, when I was coming in and out of here getting drunk all the time, and I'd go, you know, look at other people and look away from them. His name was David F., rest his soul. So then I called him up and I said, would you help me stay sober? And he said, oh, you did it again, eh, butthead? I cleaned that up, of course. He said, yeah, read the preface and call me back. And he hung up the phone. So I got the big book and I read the preface and I called him back. Well, he said, you're second fastest so far. And I found out what he was doing. He wanted to see how willing I was. I've asked many fellas over the years, yeah, read the preface and call me back, and I never hear from them again. We don't give up till we're dead 6 months. We really don't. I didn't want to. I had to be transformed by something else in my case. Not everybody gets what I was just talking about. If you don't get one of those, and yours is the educational variety, I believe today that's because it's supposed to be in your case. In my case, I just couldn't. No. Nobody home. So I started taking the steps with this fellow, started going through the big book with him. We'd read a chapter, doctor's opinion. I tell him what I saw, then he'd tell me what I was really saying. So we went through the book like that, and into the steps, and he got to that part where it says something about step three, and made a decision, snapped the book closed, said, "Got a decision to make, call me when you made it." He's gone. I said, "Holy crap, what am I supposed to do now?" So I'd see him in a meeting, "You make that decision yet?" No. "Make that decision yet?" Because we went to a lot of the same meetings. About the third meeting, he said, "You make that decision yet?" And I showed him where it says, "Being careful, making sure we're ready." And he said to me, "My friend, you don't have time to make sure you're ready." And I heard him. And it suggests, of course, we take that third step with somebody, loving sponsor, loving mate, blah, blah, blah. I didn't trust my wife because many, many years before that, I told her something in confidence, and then her brother came back and teased me about it. She was written off the list. I don't tell her anything now. Yeah. I come from a family, you don't get second chances. I learned that later. My family, you don't get a second chance. I learned that a little better now, huh, Peggy? Anyway, and with regard to my Peggy's an alky, you know. And I was dating these Al-Anons. I could pick them out of a crowd. There it went. I was dating these Al-Anons, and my daughter, who was sober longer than me, one time said, "Dad, why don't you get you a good alky woman?" And I'm going to cuss because that's what my daughter did. I said, "Why do you want me to get a good alky?" "Because she'll tell you to piss up a tree," she said. And she will. And she's had to a couple of times. But we get along pretty good. Anyway, so I started going through this and taking the steps. And when I told him, "Making sure you're ready," he said, "No, you're not." So the reason I shared about not trusting my wife, and I didn't understand it then, but I didn't trust anybody, really. So I went Friday night, which I did many, many times. I went to my knees Friday night. "When is this done? When am I done? Am I done yet? 11:30? I don't know. Okay, anyway. Give me this." I went to my knees that Friday night, and I said that third step prayer by myself. And that particular Sunday following, my first wife was still married, or my wife and my daughter had to go somewhere, do something. They left without a second thought. I walked in, pulled up the roll top desk, pulled out the several pencils, erasers broken off that my sponsor gave me, so I couldn't erase anything, and took his four-step guide taken directly from the big book and started writing. I just started writing. And the crazy New Yorker became monk. I had two sponsors. David was taking me through the book. 3 weeks after I was sober, my friend Jerry became my, I don't know what you call him, life sponsor. He taught me that, Rube, it's okay to breathe. He was one of those guys. He was one of those old, if anybody's, looks like there's a couple might be old enough to remember this. Those siding guys used to scam people out of their money in New York, selling aluminum siding. He was one of those guys when he was a drunk. So he had some amazing stories about that. Anyway, he came back in my life. And so he came to work for me. I still had a little bit of a company left. He came to work for me. And anyway, he was vital in my, one of those guys that said things like this. I'd be in my self-pity, which I was quite a bit, poor Eddie. And he'd say, "Jesus, Rube, get off the cross. We need the wood." One of those guys. And I'd have some kind of a problem, and I'd say, "I'm taking this to him. He's going to get mad at me, but I'm going to tell him about this." And I'd go in and I'd get my... And he came back so loving and so soft, like work. I was out of work, you know. And so I said, "Oh, what's the matter in AA? You can't go to a meeting without hearing these guys talking about, I went to work for 50 cents a day in a car wash." And I went, blah, 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 blah. And he came back nice and soft and factual and said, "Rube, I know it sounds like that. What they really meant was they took anything coming down the pike to stay out of here for 8 hours. And 2 days later, I got a job delivering blueprints, $5 an hour. So, but he was good for that kind of thing. And then once I was struck sober and taken these steps, he gave me this four-step guide Now, when I first come around her, and when I last ended up coming around her, I thought I was a humble, you guys didn't understand me. I was a humble, modest man, good to all people, who just drank too much. That's what I was. He gave me this directly from the big book, resentments. Only this thing that he gave me said mother, father, sisters, brothers, friends, playmates, school teachers, and went on down the line. And this guy had no resentments when he got here. 18 pages of them when I was done writing. I had something against everybody from the time I can remember. Everybody, my friends, this one particular fellow who was one of my best friends growing up, we'd have an argument, and he'd say, well, at least I have a dad. He went on the list. And he was on the list until I did that inventory. So I had 18 pages of resentments. Fears. I was afraid of everything. I really was. I was a guy who walked around, I don't know how to describe this. I went into the Marine Corps, and they taught me how to march straight up and all that stuff. So I walked around like that. And I was kind of like I'd sit in the bar and I'd sit like I'm a threat to you, but if you came up and said, hey, I'd, you know, one of those. That's what I was. So the fears, I had loads of fears. One was a fear of bees, and one was a fear of, dreadful fear of spiders. If I was to go to bed that night and there was a spider in the room, nobody went to bed till he was dead. Don't know how long we had to look, where we had to go. And it was the same with bees. Now, in this inventory, I find out this. The reason I'm afraid of bees, when I was a little kid, we had a crack in our sidewalk where I lived in Pittsburgh, and there was a hole there, and yellow and black big brown bees lived in there. I was going to help my mother out and get rid of them, and I stuffed newspaper and started on fire. They got me 7 times going down the road. That's why I was afraid of bees. With regards to spiders, when I was a little kid living in the country, the older brothers and sisters would take these tops off the tomatoes, the little top off the tomatoes, take a spider and they'd throw it at me. And it made me deathly afraid of spiders. Now, no psychologist or psychiatrist told me that. But after that, I got evidence that I wasn't afraid of them anymore, within reason, black widows of them. But I was driving down the street one day and there was a honeybee on my windshield. And I just rolled down the window and said, come on, get out of there. And I thought, well, I'll be damned. I would have never done that over the side before. And no, nothing would have happened till he was dead. So that kind of thing is what I was learning. Getting rid of the defects of character that I didn't think I had, I just started working on them. A lot of them I was still, and today, I'm sure there's still some. A lot less than there were, but there were defects in my character that I considered pride, I considered ambition, nothing on you, just crap in here. And I've learned since what they were, ego-feeding propositions on my behalf. Whether it was self-pity and I was trying to get something off of you, or whether I knew I could master you and I was trying to get something off of you. I learned those kind of basic things in the defects of character. Making amends, I started out making amends to my family. Assuring my first wife and my children that if there's anything I could do for them, I sure would, blah, blah. And when I made my amends to my daughter, who was already sober, we both sat there and cried at the Chatsworth Park, hugged each other. I made amends to my son, and my son was just like me, 15 years old, he wanted to quit school. He was very intelligent. They sent him to a special electronics class in high school. He taught himself. I taught him nothing. But they sent him to a special class and he quit school. And he didn't go to school one day and I came home and had a talk with him, told him, blah, blah, I didn't go to school because and when you graduate, it won't be a new car, but we are going to buy you a car. Gave him the pitch. Next day I come home, my wife said, he didn't go to school today. And I went and smacked him around, beat him off every wall until he was begging me to quit. That's the kind of dad I was. You will do as I say. So anyway, when I made amends to him, he said, oh, Dad, you weren't that bad. And I really knew better in his case. So that's been a living amends, and still is. But I have respect. They may not even love me, but they do respect me today. So I took care of that. And amends to my first wife, told her the same thing I told them. Was there anything I could do for you? And it was going along pretty good, but the only thing I could figure out is we just started parting ways. And the final, I was 2 years sober, and we had a big fight about the air conditioning unit. She wanted to, it was 100, we live in the valley, 100 degrees outside, you should be up to 85. You don't want it too different because the kids will catch cold. And I would tell her, geez, the U.S. government allows you to put it at 78. So, different things that I had to learn. And I talked to a lady, a friend of mine back then, about that particular thing and said, Ed, you have to compromise. Oh, compromise? What do you mean? Half the time we keep it at 78, half the time 85? And she said, yeah. Uh-huh. I didn't like that. Anyway, in the final analysis, the only thing I hadn't liked that lady, and I tried to run away from that marriage many, many times while we were still married. And a little over 6 years sober, I couldn't stay there anymore. I just couldn't stay. I called her up on Friday night and said, I'm not coming home. Not coming home tonight, not coming home. Wait, what? I said, I'm not coming home. I hung up the phone. I went and got a room, and wonderful lesson I taught after leaving there. Because I never realized how afraid I was on my own. I had my mother while I was being raised. I had the Marine Corps for 3 years. And then I had my second mommy, my first wife. And so the guy went out, I rented the room, had the check all written. He went out to get a clothes rack for me. And I can't do this. I've got to go home. And he said, I'll tell you what. I'll just hold the room for a couple of days. If you change your mind, the room's here. And just like this, it came to me. I don't go home today. Just as smooth and peaceful as it could be, I don't go home today. And I handed him the check. And I never went back since. Now, I gave up some stuff when we finally got divorced. We had a home, of course, and had about $100,000 worth of equity in the home. And my wife called me up and said, I would like you to quit claim that house over to me. And I said, I got a better idea. Half that house is mine. And that's the way it stayed for a while. Another one of these. Friday nights, I go to my knee, pray about it. Next thing you know, I'm sitting at that roll-up desk. I'm like, $35,000. I got sued. I got out of business. And I called her up. I said, it's yours. Why? On the other end. I know. What's his angle? What's his shoe? I don't tell you that to be some kind of hero. She had that coming, so she got it. And around here we're learned also to cease fighting everything and everyone. I do it way better than I used to, certainly not wonderfully, but I do it as best I can. And ended up being back in the bread business. God's doing, not mine. Ended up with a 20-year retirement from the Teamsters. We got divorced. She used to get half. We wrote up all the legal stuff, senator. She called me. I had a paralegal lady, I think. Anyway, my wife called her up and said, I want 3/4 of it. And the lady called me and told me, I said, give it to her. Give it to her. She's fighting everything and everyone. I'm not afraid of that. Give it to her. Give her the whole dang thing if she wants it. I don't care. And so she still gets that. Anyway, I just, since I was struck sober, I'm learning to live like this. On a scale of 1 to 10, my hope is to be a number 5. Just one among many, not the one that has to be on top, not the one that has to be servile and scraping down on the bottom. Just do my job. I'll tell you one last story. Am I going over? Time? Is it time now? And one last quick story about my daughter, not about me. I got a wonderful lesson in it. After my daughter was sober a short while, she was a member of this company, a partner in the company, doing mortgage, whatever they do, refis and stuff. They all went to Vegas on a celebration trip one of the guy partners made a pass at my daughter, who's very pretty, and her husband's very big. And he picked this guy up and put him against the wall. When they came back down, they demoted my daughter, took away her partnership, cut her salary in half, and she went and told her sponsor, I'm quitting him. And the sponsor told her, you go in every morning, you go in Monday morning and give that lady a cup of coffee and say, what can I do for you today? And I won't tell you what my daughter answered, but I'll give you a hint. I call her my Marine in the trenches. So that'll give you some idea, I think. So my daughter screamed, yelled and ran and raved, and she said, you go in there Monday morning, give her a cup of coffee, ask her what you can do for her. Every day my daughter ran into the when tomorrow morning you give that lady a cup of coffee, say, what can I do for you today? My daughter did that. I thought it was several months. I think my daughter told me recently it was like 3 weeks. She was offered another job in another company. And so she called and told her sponsor. Her sponsor said, yeah, you fulfilled your contract. You can take that job. So my daughter went in with the flight room short. Friday's my last day. I'm out of here. Everything got quiet. So she went in Friday and they offered her partnership with more percentage than she got before, all kind of benefits, all kind of this, all kind of that, and she ended up staying there. Love wins. That's what I got. You can't beat it. You do anything you want. You can't beat somebody who keeps giving. They'll either be out of your life or they'll change. I've experienced it time after time. I've been absolutely blessed beyond imagination to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're in this room today and you haven't had that yet, I hope and I pray that this is your day. Thank you so much. Thank you.